This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. In today's health segment, people with rare diseases help each other using the internet. But first, in an increasingly interconnected world, speaking more than one language is becoming common. Approximately 1 out of 5 Americans speak a language other than English at home. Around the world, as many as 2/3 of children are brought up bilingual. And it turns out that being bilingual is also good for the brain. Reporter Gretchen Kuta-Crowen has the story.
So, milyen volt az utad?
Nagyon jó. Kicsit fárasztó.
Judy and Paul Senkinai both grew up in the U.S. bilingual, speaking Hungarian with their families and English with their peers. And when they married, they knew they wanted to raise their children speaking both languages. So their two daughters, Hannah and Julia, heard only Hungarian from mom and dad at home. Then came school and learning English. Judy recalls Hannah's first few months with the new language.
When she did go to preschool, that accent was very thick. She's counting like 1, 2, 3, and by the time maybe 4 or 5 months went by, she's totally gone.
Most people were supportive, but not everyone. Judy's husband, Paul, recalls an uncomfortable confrontation Judy once had in a local grocery store.
I remember one time you came home and you said this one lady was, well, when's she going to learn English? It's like, well, when she goes to school, she'll learn English.
The Zenkinais say that people often ask them if their kids got confused or if they fell behind in school. Janet Worker has an answer for them. She's a psychologist at the University of British Columbia who studies language acquisition in bilingual babies. Worker says that the idea that children exposed to two languages from birth become confused or that they fall behind is a common misconception.
Growing up bilingual is just as natural as growing up monolingual. There's absolutely no evidence that bilingual acquisition leads to confusion, and there's no evidence that bilingual acquisition leads to delay.
Worker and other researchers say the evidence to the contrary is actually quite strong. Being bilingual, they say, may actually be good for you. Ellen Bialystok, a psychologist from York University in Toronto, says the reason lies in the way the bilingual mind uses language. No matter what language a person is speaking at the moment, Bialystok says both languages are active in the brain.
The evidence is very dramatic. Even if you're in a context that's utterly monolingual, where you think there's absolutely no reason to think about Chinese or Spanish or French, it is part of the activated network that's going on in your brain.
This means bilinguals have to do something that monolinguals don't do. They have to keep the two languages separate. Bialystok likens it to tuning into the right signal on the radio or television. The brain has to keep the two channels separate and pay attention to only one.
The brain has a perfectly good system whose job it is to do just that. It's the executive control system. That's what it does. It focuses attention on what's important and ignores misleading distraction. Therefore, for a bilingual, every time you open your mouth to speak, you recruit this executive control system. It's always used in every sentence you utter. That's what makes it strong.
Bialystok says that constantly engaging this executive control function is a form of mental exercise. And some researchers, including herself, believe that this can be beneficial for the brain. Bilingual speakers have been shown to perform better on a variety of cognitive tasks. And one study Bialystok did found that dementia set in 4 to 5 years later in people who spent their lives speaking two languages instead of one.
They can get a little extra mileage out of these cognitive networks because they have been enhanced throughout life.
And the advantages of bilingualism may be due to more than just mental fitness. Bialystok says there's some preliminary evidence that being bilingual may physically remodel parts of the brain. For NPR News, I'm Gretchen Kuta-Crowen in Cleveland.
In Japan today, workers at the disabled nuclear power plant started to pump moderately radioactive water into the ocean. The effort is meant to make room at the facility for water that's more severely contaminated. NPR's Richard Harris has the latest.
Repair workers can't fully restore the power plant's cooling systems until they can get rid of water that's been pooling up in tunnels and ditches in and around the power plants. They've pumped some of that water into holding tanks, but they ran out of space there, so now they're starting to pump this fluid out into the ocean. It's enough water to fill about 5 Olympic swimming pools. Most of the radioactive material in the water is an isotope called iodine-131, which fortunately doesn't last very long. It will essentially decay away to nothing in the next few months. Of course, in the meantime, fish and seaweed can take it up, so there are restrictions on harvesting seafood from the area. Japanese officials apologize for having to dump radioactive material into the ocean, but they hope the maneuver will allow them to contain more severely contaminated water they also have to contend with. Richard Harris, NPR News.
The earthquake and tsunami left hundreds of thousands homeless, and the nuclear crisis that followed has forced thousands more to evacuate their homes. Some residents from the area around the Fukushima Daiichi plant have taken shelter 150 miles south in Tokyo. NPR's Greg Dixon visited some of them.
The Tokyo Budokan is on the outskirts of the city. Before the earthquake, it was a martial arts performance space. Now it is a temporary home for over 250 people. Because it was meant for martial arts competition, there were already plenty of tatami mats on hand. In the largest performance hall, the mats cover the floor. Boxes and chairs outline personal space containing few possessions. Empty stadium seats ring the space above. Down a hallway, tables are covered with boxes of donated clothing and food. 61-year-old Yoshiharu Niizuma sits in an alcove. He says life at the shelter is comfortable.
There's plenty of food here. The government workers are kind. The meals are excellent, and there's a lot of clothing available.
Niizuma lives just 3 miles from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, and he doesn't know when it will be safe to return. Phones are available for residents to make free calls, and a few computers for email, although children use them to play video games. 76-year-old retiree Hitoshi Yamada passes the time by reading a newspaper. His house is outside the evacuation zone and survived the quake and tsunami, but he left home anyway.
We're not getting clear information. Because nuclear material is invisible, we didn't know how safe we were, so we got scared and left. Unless there is a 100% guarantee of safety, I'm not going back.
But some people have no choice but to return. Kyoko Kobayashi came to the shelter with 14 members of her extended family. Four have had to return north to go to work. She lives 25 miles from the plant in an area the government says is safe.
To be honest with you, I don't believe what they say.
But she may have to go back, whether she believes them or not.
Because I want to support my kid. I want to work and make money.
Are you nervous to go back?
Of course, she says. 3 weeks after the terrible destruction brought by the earthquake and tsunami, for Kobayashi and many other people from around Fukushima, fear of radiation, whether justified or not, keeps them from rebuilding their lives. Greg Dixon, NPR News, Tokyo.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And next, our series, Muses and Metaphor. As part of our celebration of National Poetry Month, we will be hearing your poetic tweets. We've been asking you to send us poems that are 140 characters or less through Twitter. And today we hear a tweet from Stephanie Payne. She's a senior editor, writer, and graphic designer at CD Room, Inc., and a contributor to a variety of online and print lifestyle publications. Stephanie says that when she isn't traveling to remote locations around the world, she lives in Washington, D.C. Now remember, these are short, only 140 characters each. Here's a poetic tweet by Stephanie Payne.
My name is Stephanie Payne, and this is my tweet. Forging the slide, a wild chimp at my side, we swept the mountain as a downpour fell from the wide open sky.
Now those are short, so let's hear it again.
Forging the slide, a wild chimp at my side, we swept the mountain as a downpour fell from the wide open sky.
That's a poetic tweet submitted by Stephanie Payne of Washington, D.C. If you'd like to help us celebrate National Poetry Month, go to Twitter and tweet us your original poetry using fewer than 140 characters, of course. If your poem is chosen, we will help you record it for us, and we will air it sometime during the month of April. Tweet us using the hashtag TMMPoetry. You can learn more at the Tell Me More website. Go to npr.org, click on the programs menu to find Tell Me More.
Katie Couric is said to be in the final stages of negotiations that will lead to her departure from the CBS Evening News. She's the first woman to solo anchor a network weeknight newscast. The news ratings for all three networks have been steadily declining, though they've been particularly meager at CBS. Well, NPR media correspondent David Folgenflik joins me now from our studios in New York to talk about all this. And David, Katie Couric has said publicly she's considering a syndicated talk show. What's the state of play with her right now? How close is she to that?
Well, her contract is up in June, and she's been talking to a number of people, including her former boss at NBC News, Jeff Zucker, about creating a syndicated talk show that might highlight her renowned interviewing skills and personability. She's talked a little bit at CBS continuing, perhaps through the end of the election, according to people I've talked to at the network and one of her associates. But it's not clear exactly whether she'll do that. She's been unhappy at being blamed for CBS's problems in the evening news. And they've been unhappy with the big paycheck they've been handing her without a significant rise in ratings.
What legacy has she built in her 5 years at CBS? Hard to believe it's already been 5 years.
That's right. Well, you can view it a couple of different ways. One of the first main things that Les Moonves, the chairman of the CBS network, wanted to do was to clear the slate and cleanse the palate from the debacle of the Memogate scandal with Dan Rather than the anchor and the story about President Bush's military service. They did that. You know, they had an interim anchor, Bob Schieffer. She took over, and all the attention was on this new star, fresh from NBC's Today Show. She'd changed the story entirely. Unfortunately, she didn't change the ratings entirely. In fact, her ratings are a bit worse than they were under Bob Schieffer. That's been an issue. Her journalism was a little bit a rocky record there as well. If you look at what she did at the start, she tried to change the nature of the network newscast, introduce more interviews. It didn't take. After quick sampling, her ratings declined. She instituted a more conventional newscast, and it stabilized. She did some awfully good stories, for example, with those interviews with Sarah Palin during the 2008 elections, and people began to respect what she was building. I think it's also important to note that Couric's salary of $15 million both branded her a celebrity that's almost drowned out what journalism was performed on that newscast, but it also diverted resources that were desperately needed to cover the kinds of stories happening when she was named 5 years ago and what are happening now. They're trying to cover stories in Japan, in the Middle East, all the tumult of all those countries there, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. These are expensive propositions, and what she did diverted resources, and that's been a real point of contention within the network.
You know, when you reach back to the era of Rather and Jennings and Brokaw, it seemed like getting an anchor job in the past was much like a lifetime appointment, much like a Supreme Court justice. What's changed now? These chairs seem to rotate so much more.
Well, I think what's changed is that the question of holding one of these jobs is no longer being one of the highest priests of journalism, because the notion of authoritativeness has been undermined. Even the New York Times does not command, in some ways, as absolute a voice about what is news and what isn't anymore. For these anchors, as their audiences have been shrinking in a combined way very much over the years, it's a smaller megaphone, a smaller platform from which to operate. And therefore, it may be that Katie Couric, who's been the butt of jokes for her pay and ratings, who's been struggling a little bit within her own organization, may want to return to something that plays more to her strengths. And I think you're seeing, in some ways, the shrinking of the relevance of the major network news anchor.
That's NPR's David Folgenflik. David, thanks so much.
You bet.
This is NPR. A lot of attention has been paid to the way bookstores and publishing companies are managing the e-book revolution, but far less has been paid to the role of libraries. When HarperCollins recently announced that it would limit the number of times its e-books can be borrowed, it sparked a larger conversation about the future of libraries in the digital age. NPR's Lynn Neary has the story.
You don't have to go anywhere near a library to check out an e-book. You can download it onto your digital device in a matter of seconds. And there's no more pesky overdue notices. The ebook simply disappears from your device when your time is up.
The fact is that with a digital item, if you give it to somebody, you still have it. It doesn't have to come back.
Eli Nyberger is the director for IT and production at the Ann Arbor District Library in Michigan. E-books, says Nyberger, are really digital files, but libraries and publishers are still trying to deal with them as if they're just like print books, and they're trying to do business the way they have always done business.
Part of the models that we've seen so far are still trying to force 20th century business models onto digital content, and any digital native says, what, you mean I have to wait to download an e-book? What sense does that make? And they're off to the Kindle store to spend, what, you know, $3.99 or $4.99 or $9.99 to get that same book.
In the current climate, libraries worry they'll become obsolete. Publishers are afraid they won't be able to make any money. That's why HarperCollins came up with a new ebook policy, which says its ebooks can only be checked out 26 times before they have to be repurchased. Leslie Hulse, a senior vice president at HarperCollins, says publishers have to place some limitations on the way libraries loan ebooks.
So I think the tension is, at the extreme, we could be making a book available to one national library on a simultaneous access model in perpetuity. And what that would mean is that everyone in the country could check out that book for free at any time, and that's not a sort of a commercially viable solution.
HarperCollins may have raised the ire of librarians around the country with their new e-book policy, but Christopher Platt, director of collections and circulation at the New York Public Library, says the move has also stimulated a lot more public discussion about the future of libraries and e-books.
The HarperCollins limit of 26 checkouts per item isn't going to stick. It's going to develop into something new. And Harper, to their credit, is very engaged with libraries and reaching out to them now to see really what would work.
Platt has his own ideas about what might work for the future. He says libraries use intermediaries to manage both their physical and digital book collections. He thinks libraries could work with these intermediaries to develop subscription packages of e-books. Libraries would pay the publishers for these subscriptions and use them as they see fit.
So I buy a title with 1,000 uses, right? And then it's up to us and our readers, the library readers, whether those 1,000 uses get used simultaneously in the first few days or whether they're drawn out over time. And then if they do get used very quickly, we'll buy more.
Eli Nyberger has a more radical idea. He thinks libraries could deal directly with content providers.
The goal of the library is to obtain the ability to distribute content to its public. And if we can do that easier and more cheaply with the rights holder or the artist themselves, and they make more money on it, you know, it may be heretical, but you know, the future usually is.
That idea has potential, says Christopher Platt, but it may not be practical in the long run.
In some scenarios, that will happen and that will grow. You will see more original content coming into library collections going forward. And I think that's a wonderful thing, especially if libraries play a role in the creation of that content. But on a regular matter of just ordering at scale the number of ebooks that we add to our collection, that's a very difficult thing to manage.
From the traditional to the visionary, the conversation about libraries in the digital age has begun in earnest. Roberta Stevens, president of the American Library Association, wants more publishing companies to get involved in the conversation because at the moment, some publishers aren't even willing to sell ebooks to libraries. Libraries may be able to survive without those books now, says Stevens, but in the future, a lot of books will only be available electronically.
When we look at the future, then we have to really think very seriously about what is our role and how can we actually serve the millions and millions of people who use our public libraries every day if we can't even get access to titles.
Libraries have always been thought of as a kind of temple of books, a place you can go to for peace and quiet, a place to read and think. They're an intricate part of the fabric that pulls a community together. But if they are to be relevant in the future, they'll have to make space for themselves in the digital community as well. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Our program is directed by Jonathan Baer, edited by Corey Turner and Allison McAdam, and produced by Graham Smith. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. The engineering supervisor is Robert Jackson. Our planning editor is Jerry Holmes. The staff includes Lauren Silverman, Julia Buckley, Bracton Booker, Andrea Hsu, Gabe O'Connor, Carol Klinger, Viet Le, Jennifer Longmire Wright, and Rhonda Ray. Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. The managing editor for NPR News is David Sweeney. I'm Michelle Norris, and you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Social media is all about now, about what's going on in this very moment. Twitter asks what's happening when it prompts you to update. But Alex Schmidt reports on one news service that's promising the exact opposite, a kind of social media scrapbook.
My sister Anita has been on Facebook since the beginning, 7 years. She's been posting pictures that entire time.
Usually it's either like friends or family or like novelty. Just something I think is really funny or random that I see.
She hasn't exactly considered that she's been creating a history of her life. A new product called Memo Lane makes a graphic online album on a timeline by date of all your social media history. Twitter, Facebook, Flickr, YouTube, Last.fm, Vimeo, Foursquare.
Wait, okay, this was funny, actually. Wait, what were we doing?
Anita and I used Memo Lane to look back at a trip to Paris we took 3 years ago. Pictures, tweets, all of it.
We both at the same time decided to take a picture of ourselves with the Notre Dame Cathedral, and it was a competition to see who could take a better picture of the two of us with Notre Dame. But look, mine is totally better.
We created photo albums after the trip, but neither of us had realized that our social media usage from that time could be an album itself.
Our experience on the internet is just at the very, very beginning.
Marshall Kirkpatrick is a co-editor of the tech blog Read Write Web.
We are producing so much more data now than ever before. It's not going away, but that's always been thought of as a problem and not an opportunity.
With a product like Memo Lane, we can instantly access a detailed historic record of our lives. But that could change the way we feel about our past. Jeff Olick is a professor of sociology at the University of Virginia who studies memory. He says in order to feel nostalgic, we need to have distance from the past.
So if these sites make our past more present to us, then it may end up failing to create that sense of distance.
So say you moved out of an old apartment and then looked at a picture of it every single day after. You probably wouldn't miss it too much.
So maybe it'll make us less nostalgic.
My sister and I hadn't relived our Paris experience for a while, so the memories held their magic.
Miss Finch, ready for her close-up.
Nice as it was, Anita doesn't plan to constantly go over the past on Memo Lane.
It allows you to, like, you know, stroll down memory lane, but that's not something that everybody needs to do every single day.
Maybe not, but a sappy procrastinator like me could end up strolling more often than I should. For NPR News, I'm Alex Schmidt.